This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 245, was recorded on November 12th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Masterworks.io, which gives investors of any size the opportunity to invest in the $1.7 trillion fine art market through fractional ownership, and by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium. Economic cycles guru Lakshman Achuthan returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll build on Locke's May 7th interview on Macro Voices and talk about why Locke sees an inflation cycle on the near horizon. We'll also discuss where we stand in the economic cycle and the outlook for financial markets. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick has prepared another of his famous chart books.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, before we even get to the stock market, how do you see the big picture in the wake of the election and the vaccine news that came out this week?
You know, Patrick, I think this should be called National Fake News Week. I mean, over the weekend, we hear that the election's over, Joe Biden is president-elect, it's a done deal, Trump is out, Biden is in. And then the other news was the blue wave didn't happen, and the GOP keeps the Senate. So, you know, this was all presented as if it was a certainty. Then Monday morning, we get news that Pfizer's new vaccine is a game changer, completely changes everything, ought to be approved for mass use by Christmas, you know, pandemic is over. Hooray. The thing is, no part of any of that is true. It's all complete nonsense. The election works the way we described it last week. There is no president elect. We won't know for sure who is president until January 6th, although, frankly, that's a technicality because by December 14th, everything but the possibility of a last-minute objection will have been ruled out. And frankly, both houses of Congress upholding an objection seems profoundly unlikely in this environment. But technically, we don't really know who the president is until January 6th. And between now and December 14th, we talked last week about unfaithful electors and all the things that can happen. Now, I'll be the first to acknowledge that it is very, very likely that Joe Biden is going to win. But this nonsense about calling him president-elect, he's not president-elect of anything. The election is not over yet. And it's very, very likely and almost certain that Biden is going to win, but it is not done yet. And frankly, people who are saying, oh, every other president, you know, has always conceded, Gore didn't concede until December 12th, the meeting of electors, which this year it'll be December 14th. So, you know, President Trump is doing exactly what Biden would be doing if this had gone the other way. Now, before I'm accused of taking sides, I'm not trying to side with President Trump here. One of the things that's being presented, one of the bits of fake news, is that the Democrats did not get their blue wave and they didn't take the Senate. Frankly, there's a very real possibility, a much greater possibility, I would say, of the Democrats still taking the Senate after the runoff elections in Georgia in January. So that is still possible, and it's not over yet. So it could be that the Democrats, it would actually be a tie, but if there's a tie and you've got a 50-50 split in the Senate, then the tie-breaking vote is cast by the vice president. You can count on Kamala Harris to take the Democrats' side on pretty much any vote. So you can still have the blue wave happen. And all this stuff that's being presented as if the election over is simply fake news. Now let's get to the real news about the coronavirus COVID crisis. There has been a massive increase in both infections and deaths, both globally and in the United States. To put this in perspective, that big scary peak that we had in April was when we got to the point of 35,000 new cases per day in the United States. The last few days have been more than 135,000 new cases per day. Yesterday was 143,000 new cases. Globally, April was about 85,000 new cases. It's now over 600,000. And we had also a new record of more than 10,000 deaths in a single day. day yesterday for the first time. So the Northern Hemisphere is leading, suggesting for a while we thought the seasonality of cold weather didn't really have anything to do with it. Seems like maybe it does, because this resurgence in deaths and new cases is primarily happening in the Northern Hemisphere as the weather gets colder. And then on Monday, for about the fifth time in this pandemic, you'd think we would have learned by now to recognize obvious patterns. What happens? We have some relatively mundane news, which is positive results in a clinical trial. It's great news, don't get me wrong, but it's not game-changing. It doesn't mean the pandemic is over. It was a perfect opportunity for the CEO of Pfizer to follow in the footsteps of the CEO of Moderna and do what? Sell most of his stock on the rally, because he's smart enough to know that this is nonsense. So the Pfizer CEO sells more than half of his personal holdings in Pfizer stock on this stock rally. It's not a game changer, folks. This is approximately the same thing as the Moderna news. Some pretty good news that says they're getting some positive results and they're making some progress in a clinical trial. It doesn't mean that there's a vaccine that's ready to be rolled out. Now, what's real here? RNA viruses are tricky because the antibodies don't last very long if you use a conventional vaccine. This is a brand new kind of vaccine called an mRNA, messenger RNA vaccine. And the significance of that is it doesn't only stimulate the creation of antibodies, it also stimulates T-cell immunity, which is a different kind of immunity. That potentially could mean that the immune effects last longer than a conventional vaccine. But this is a brand new thing. They've never even done a clinical trial of an mRNA vaccine on human beings before. Nothing has ever been approved. It's brand new. So this Pfizer vaccine might very well turn out to be very important. I'm not discounting that. Time will tell. But it's not known yet. It's not as if the vaccine is ready to go and the pandemic ends next week, which is the way that the market seems to have interpreted the news this week. Meanwhile, what nobody's talking about is the mink strain, which frankly is very concerning. The executive summary of this is the virus has jumped from human beings to another species, minks in this case, the little rat-sized animals that they make mink coats from, and it mutated and then got passed back to human beings. And the significance of this is that when a virus jumps from one species to another, from, in this case, humans to minks and then back to humans, for reasons that are way beyond my pay grade, that apparently makes mutations more likely, including mutations that might render a vaccine that worked on the old strain completely inoperative on the new strain. And I have no idea what the medical explanation is for why it works that way, but I'm told that's how it works. The point is, what's really going on is there's a huge upturn in cases, a huge upturn in deaths, new news about this mink strain, which for the first time proves that this virus can jump from humans to another species and back to humans again, which may have some very significant consequences in terms of how long a given vaccine would be effective, and perhaps a new vaccine would have to be developed each time this jumping from species happens. Most of the news, the balance or preponderance of news, is very negative. But the one headline that seems to have occupied everybody's attention is the Pfizer headline, which makes perfect sense. It sets the Pfizer CEO up to sell his stock. So congratulations, sir. I'm glad you made a good profit. Maybe the rest of the market will catch up with reality sometime soon. But let's come back to the presidential election. Now, as I said, the election is not over. There is no president-elect. But it seems very likely at this point that Joe Biden is going to win, even though he hasn't quite yet. Remember Dr. Pippa Malmgren's prediction made, I think, 3 years ago on Macro Voices, where she said, look, as soon as Trump can't get reelected, he's going to start his own news network to compete with CNN and Fox News and so forth. And what she predicted is that that would be a step up, not down, in power for Donald Trump, moving out of the Oval Office, out of the White House, and into his new TV studio behind his gold-plated news desk or whatever he's going to have. That, in Pippa's assessment, and remember, she worked in the White House as a presidential advisor. She knows what she's talking about. In her assessment, she thinks that is a step up in power, not down, for Donald Trump. So it's going to be very interesting to see where that goes. And just today, President Trump is tweeting to his followers, encouraging them to dump Fox News and intimating his plans for a new digital network designed to crush Fox News. So it seems that Pippa's prediction is coming true even before the official results of the election are even announced. So I think it's probably most likely that Joe Biden is going to win the presidential election. It seems nearly certain at this point. And when he does, President Trump is going to take up residence behind a gold-plated news desk at the Trump News Network. And that's going to be really, really interesting. We need to try to get Pippa back to talk more about that scenario.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the S&P 500, because once that vaccine news came out, the S&P 500 just rockets higher to an all-time new high, and then the markets just give it all back. And we're not necessarily selling off yet, but we certainly are not following through on any buying and are not really holding anywhere near above all the previous highs in September and October. What's your take on all of this?
You know, it's really interesting. On the vaccine news, it was an instantaneous reaction of stocks straight up, oil straight up, gold straight down. And as you say, the stock market retraced most of it pretty quickly. I think it was before the closing bell on Monday afternoon that the stock market had woken up and said, hey, wait a minute, you know, the crisis is not really over. But the oil market just kept going to the upside, and really the gold market didn't recover. So bottom line, Patrick, I don't think the market is yet in touch with the negative side of the coronavirus news. It seems like the initial, okay, the Pfizer vaccine changes everything, this is the game changer, the pandemic's over, that came back out of the market. But what didn't get read into the market is the fact that we've got a really big increase in cases and infections, and also this mink strain news, which is brand news, and the scientists are still trying to figure out what it means, but it doesn't sound good. That stuff has not been digested yet, as far as I can tell. One way or another, I doubt that President Trump is going to win, but I do think that the resolution of this stock market situation will be upside. It'll resolve to the upside once we've gotten past any uncertainty. We know for certain what the outcome of the election is, and then you know there's more stimulus coming. So I think eventually this resolves to the upside, but I think there might be a little bit more volatility as maybe we come to terms with the fact that there really is no president-elect quite yet.
All right, let's move on to the dollar index, because the dollar immediately sold off. We were trading down at the 92 handle. The euro was up along the 119 level. It really looked like the US dollar weakness was coming in there. Now, we bounced a little bit. We're back toward the 93 level, but by no means are dollar bulls back added to the upside. Do you think there's more downside to the dollar from here?
Well, so far, you know, the 92 support level held just like it did in August. In August, there was an intraday dip below 92. We didn't even see that this time. So far, it's holding up just as well as it did in August. Until there's a clean break, a closing print below 92, I don't think there's any technical signal of significance here. The fundamentals are muddy. You know, the market can't decide between the election and the pandemic status. It doesn't seem to know how to interpret them. So I think things need to get clear before we see any clear direction. I'm not making any bets here. I think anything's possible.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because the moment that news started coming out, crude oil just started ripping. I mean, 2 weeks ago, we saw the low down along the 34 level, and suddenly we're back in the 40s. Do you think this is the real turn point for oil?
Well, it's really confusing, Patrick, because first of all, before you even get to the vaccine news, in theory, a Biden win is bullish for oil prices because of Biden's policy on fracking. You know, if U.S. producers can't frack, then that means there's less supply, and that pushes the price up. So there was certainly some upward movement on oil prices, a slow drift up higher after the futures market opened on Sunday night. But it wasn't till the vaccine news that the big, you know, just moonshot to the upside really happened. So it seems to have been driven mostly by the vaccine news. The thing is, as we talked about earlier, the stock market was straight up on the vaccine news, but it retraced by the end of the day. It didn't come out of the oil market the way that it did. Now, the crazy part is OPEC announced lower demand expectations because they seem to be paying attention to what's really going on with the coronavirus crisis and the increase in cases and so forth. So OPEC is talking about lower demand expectations. When that news came out, oil sold off, but it didn't retrace the big move up on the vaccine news. And I don't think the vaccine news was being interpreted accurately. So it's kind of backwards. Meanwhile, we got inventory delayed by a day this week. Came out today on Thursday at 11 a.m., and it was expected to be a big drawdown on crude oil inventory, which might have propelled the price higher. Turned out to be a build of 4.3 million barrels, so a pretty darn significant build in crude oil inventory this week. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 518,000 barrels. The place where we did see the big drawdowns was in the finished products. Gasoline drawing down 2.3 million barrels, and distillates drawing down a massive 5.4 million barrels. So on the one hand, we didn't see the drawdown on crude oil inventory that was expected this week, but we did see a net drawdown on petroleum products. The distillate and gasoline drawdowns together were almost double what the size of the build was in crude oil. So it wasn't quite what the market expected. Tape action was a down reaction in crude oil in reaction to that surprise build, but it wasn't even down to a new low on the day, although it did later move back down to a new low. So I think the market is just trying to come to terms with what's important and what's not, and correctly interpreting the virus and demand expectations and the various different data points. Let's come back to this, Patrick, in the post-game segment when we can look at the charts and talk about some of the levels and where this may be headed, because I don't think it's a very clear picture.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because last week on the show, we were just talking about this beautiful breakout on gold, that it looked like it was finally getting some traction. And then the moment this vaccine news came out, over $100 drop on the downside and right back down to the multi-month lows from September and October. What's going on here in your mind?
Well, Patrick, I've been saying for weeks that a clear winner in the presidential election could be a gold down scenario, especially if there's no increase in civil unrest. And essentially, that's what we have, regardless of the issue of whether or not the election should have been called already. It's pretty darn clear that Joe Biden is strongly in the lead. Most people are perceiving that he's already president-elect. So it kind of helped that that happened. But as you say, the big move down didn't really happen until the vaccine news. And again, what I find really interesting is the stock market was crazy up and it came to its senses and realized, hey, wait a minute, there's no good reason for this to be happening. And it all retraced. Gold market hasn't retraced. Now, I did end up buying here on the dip on Monday afternoon, and I don't think this is necessarily over yet. I think there's still room for a test of the 200-day moving average at 1798 now and rising slowly. But at the end of the day, you know, MMT is here to stay. Gold is definitely going higher. I think there's still room as the market stays confused a little bit and we do get a final resolution to the election and we know for sure who's president. And if the market continues to think that this Pfizer vaccine is a game changer, which I don't think it is, maybe there's room to get that technical correction down to the 200-day moving average. I would be buying much more aggressively there. I looked at this and I said, you know, I'd rather wait for the 200-day, but, you know, it could be that the market wakes up to what should be obvious, which is the Pfizer story doesn't really change anything. And maybe this is going to be the bottom. So I bought Monday so far. Unfortunately, it looks like I caught the bottom just about perfectly. I'm hoping to be proven wrong and to get another opportunity to buy even more at a lower price. We'll see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because as soon as all that news came out, the yields go ripping higher. We almost hit 100 basis points, but we're obviously back off now about 91 basis points as time of recording. What's your thinking on what's happening here with interest rates?
Well, Patrick, as our regular listeners know, I've been kind of no opinion on the bond market for a while now. I'm going to change that this week. I still have no opinion very short term, but I'm really coming around to the view that rates have probably bottomed. And I know a lot of people have been proven wrong saying this before, but I think the 38-year bond bull market probably really is over now and has reached its final conclusion. And I think that at some point, I don't know how soon, we're going to have inflation that's going going to result in higher long-term yields. Let's see what Locke has to say in the feature interview. This is certainly something he looks at very closely.
This week's feature interview guest is ECRI co-founder Lakshman Achuthan. Eric, why did we invite Locke back this week?
Well, Locke gave us a terrific interview back in May, and if you go back to that interview, which I recommend, and by the way, I tell you in the beginning to go back and listen to it. I didn't tell you where to find it. Just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, put Lakshman's name, and just start with L-A-K-S, into the search box at macrovoices.com, and you'll find that interview from May 7th. That was a great interview, and first of all, he got a lot of calls right. He said he thought that the market had bottomed, the business cycle was turning, and he talked about how we needed to watch as these trends developed, specifically for the reemergence of a self-reinforcing virtuous cycle. So I wanted to find out, okay, he got a lot of calls right in May as the crisis was beginning. How are the things that he said to look at or to focus on and keep an eye on back in that May interview, how are they evolving now? So I wanted to come back to this, and certainly with the discussion we've had with a lot of guests about whether inflation is coming and how far off it is, I wanted to pose that question as well.
Eric's interview with Locke is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you haven't already heard me talk about Masterworks.io, I encourage you to go back and listen to my interview from May with their CEO. Masterworks.io lets you invest in the $1.7 trillion art market. Art prices rose 8.9% annually between 2000 and 2018, more than double the return of the S&P. Masterworks.io recently sold their first Banksy, resulting in a 32% return. Having a portion of your wealth in alternatives like art is important during times of political uncertainty. Art had a correlation factor of just 0.13 to the stock market, the lowest correlation of the 10 major asset classes. With 97% of bonds yielding less than 5% and stocks trading over 31 times earnings, investors need a place to preserve their wealth. That's where Masterworks.io comes in. To learn more, visit Masterworks.io today. Important disclosures at Masterworks.io/disclaimer.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lakshman Achuthan, co-founder of the Economic Cycles Research Institute, or ECRI. Locke, it's great to have you back on the show. Before we get started, listeners, first of all, there is a slide deck you're going to want to download. The link is in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Here's the thing I also want you to take to heart. Locke was last on the show back in May. We did a lot of coverage of the way that ECRI analyzes cycles. So we talked about the three D's of every recession, which are depth, diffusion, and duration. We also distinguished the different types of cycles. Economic cycles can be growth cycles, they can be business cycles, they can also be inflation cycles. So understanding those differences. All of the content in that May 7th interview is as relevant today as it was the day that it was recorded. We're not going to go back and cover old ground. So I encourage new listeners, if you don't remember that interview, to go back and listen to it, because we're going to build on what we started there. Locke, I want to focus on a couple of things you told us in that interview. First of all, that was May 7th. You said you think that it looked to you like your signals were telling you that a bottom was being put in on those indicators. And boy, sure enough, from a stock market standpoint, you nailed the bottom there. But you also went on to say that you really have to be careful when things turn up. It's not just the cycle turning up, but you got to be able to distinguish, well, which cycle is it? The inflation cycle or the business cycle, the growth cycle? Which one is turning up? And you also said it's important to look for a really key event, which is the emergence of a self-reinforcing virtuous cycle. In other words, a feedback loop where whatever is causing things to turn up just keeps causing that effect to increase in its effectiveness. So clearly something's going on here because we're still in really the middle of a pandemic crisis, global infections and deaths, both globally and in the United States, are spiking up to new all-time highs. You'd think that would be really bad, yet the stock market is rallying to new all-time highs. Is this about a growth cycle? Is it about an inflation cycle? Is it the political cycle? What's going on and how should we interpret this whole story?
Yeah, no, I hear you. It is kind of mind-boggling. And thank you for the opportunity to kind of break it down. We're going to talk about business cycles. We'll talk about growth rate cycles. So once you're in a recovery, you know, what's going on with the growth? Is it accelerating or decelerating? And then separately, but super important, especially today, inflation cycles. And so just to kind of link us up and listeners up to the May interview that you just summarized. We were looking for a bottom at that time. Actually, in early April, we had, based on just some of these cycle dynamics, how far we had fallen and some bottoming in our forward-looking leading indexes, we thought it was going to be one of the shortest recessions ever, the one that we just had. And in retrospect, it looks like, technically speaking, it will be really short. I think this is going to be the shortest recession that technically in U.S. history. Of course, the end of recession does not mean recovered. We have a lot of things that we're watching to see if we can get back to where we were before the recession. And when on business cycles, so we're saying the business cycle recession has ended. We are in the business cycle recovery, meaning the level of activity continues to improve, continues to increase. And in terms of, is it self-sustaining? Is it virtuous? Do we have a positive feedback loop in the way that the economy operates? And the answer there is yes, we do. And the reason we know that we have this virtuous feedback loop is based on leading indexes. And we had talked about leading indexes like the weekly leading index starting to bottom last time, so over 6 months ago. And listeners can see a picture, a current picture of the weekly leading index growth rate on page one of the chart deck we're providing with this interview. And you could see it's run straight up. And those leading indicators, right, in the weekly leading index, reveal if indeed it's virtuous in terms of the recovery. Is it self-feeding? Or is it simply that, you know, you ran out of milk and you had to get more milk, and so now you have a little pop in activity? It's much more than that, okay? Confidence is coming back. There's pent-up demand. So there's increases in employment and income away from stimulus, which is feeding back into sales, which is helping with production. And so that cycle, each one of those items, and if you have more production, you have more people working. So that cycle is revving to the upside. And when you're in the vicinity of those cycle turns, they're quite powerful. Even though there are plenty of things to worry about, and I share the concerns of listeners about the things to worry about, the cycle is pretty darn strong and can really barrel through a lot of that stuff. And we had also discussed, Eric, how stock prices typically bottom just before the end of recessions. And in this case, the bottom, everybody knows, was in March, right? You look back on your chart for 2020 and you see, yeah, there it is. It's in middle to late March. And given our understanding of cycle dynamics on which we had based that earlier short recession call, we were able to recognize, you know, not too long after that March low, that the market had very, very likely made a cyclical bottom. So in other words, regardless of the ongoing debate about what's the Fed going to do, or how many infections are they going up or down, or, you know, what's going on with the vaccine and all those things. And you know all of the back and forth on that over the last several months. We knew that because the cycle, the direction was up, the direction of growth was up, that stock prices would keep rising at least for the next few months. You know, that was several months ago. And so I would submit that for anyone wondering if cyclical fundamentals matter to the market, this is pretty concrete evidence. And here's the thing, the same logic that I just described held in March of 2009. And I mean, it's a decade ago, right? But back then we had the same kind of situation. And in March of 2009, we had the indicators, leading indicators, the same leading indicators showing a virtuous cycle to the upside, turn up just after the market low. And you recall, or you, some listeners may recall, I think you recall, Eric, but the debate raged for months on end in 2009 about, is it a double dip? What's going on? But the leading indexes were emphatic in saying, no, it's a recovery.
Now, let's talk about what is driving the recovery, because I think one of the key distinctions that we discussed in May is, okay, it may in the beginning feel like a growth cycle bottoming and entering a virtuous cycle to the upside and an inflation cycle doing the same thing. In the beginning, they kind of look the same to the economy, but boy, they have dramatically different endings. So do we learn enough from what the indicators tell us to be able to diagnose what cycle is actually driving this at this point?
Yeah. We're really, really focused like a laser beam on the sequence of these cycles. So to be clear, first, we have the recession end. The contraction in the level of activity stopped, and the level of activity started to expand. So the growth rate of the economy started to improve, and that's a business cycle expansion begins and a growth rate cycle upturn begins at about the same time. And when we look at the leading indicators, what's driving the recovery? There is a story that to be told there. And we had talked about, and many people have talked about, the K-shaped recovery. And it happens, you know, higher income households are doing better than lower income households for a host of reasons. But it also, there's a K-shape to the sectors of the economy that have been improving. And the real foundational block of this recovery has been in the goods sector, the manufacturing sector of the economy. And that's both happening here in the United States and around the world. And so that's both a domestic and a global industrial upturn cycle that is within the overall business cycle. Separately, you've had a very strong upturn in non-residential construction. And that is also quite real. It has legs. It's not faltering. It's not a one-off kind of pop off the bottom. And the interesting thing about these two sectors is that their cyclical amplitude relative to the overall economy is quite high. It's many times the cyclical amplitude of the overall economy. So even though they don't make up the majority of the economy, which is really on the services side, they can, at times, you have a situation where like the tail's wagging the dog. And here, with the strength of these upturns, it's certainly helping overall growth continue to improve. And so we turn to services, where there was a good pop off the bottom, but that has been slowing. So it's still growing, but it's growing slower. And that's because there's a lot of people-facing kind of services activities that are hampered, of course, by the virus. And so we see that story, but we don't get too hung up on the services sector being a little less robust on its growth rate, because we see that power, that cyclical power in the goods and the construction side is really kind of lifting all boats right now.
Locke, we're talking so far conceptually about cycles and so forth. How do we actually manage risk around these prognostications that the cycles, the indicators tell us which way the cycles are headed? What do you do from a risk management standpoint in response to that?
Okay. Well, to be clear, our analytical framework is not about market timing, even though I mentioned just now a couple of lucky timing calls, okay, on growth, business cycles, and the market share prices. Our approach is really about managing cycle risk in a systematic way. And it's more than just economic growth. That's a really important cycle. And we just went through some reasons why it's so important. But one of the really, really big insights that our research group had decades ago, actually my mentor, Jeffrey Moore, is that there's separate cycles in inflation. And as simple as that sounds, it's actually really, really profound because most people don't think about it that way. So in our world, in managing cycle risk, you got to know which way to look for growth in economic activity, but you also have to be looking to get the cyclical direction right on inflation. So if you don't appreciate that inflation is cyclical, you're going to be repeatedly blindsided. And today, that's a clear and present danger. I've heard very bright people talk about inflation and very bright people talk about deflation as a result of some of the big issues that are out there with debt or with stimulus or with weak growth and structural things. So I think first, what would be super helpful is just to understand what an inflation cycle is. And so listeners can refer to page 2 of the chart deck. And here, we just have a thin line showing actual CPI inflation since the early 80s, so several decades. And then there's a thicker, just to make it easier to see, a thicker zigzag line. And those segments show upturns, cyclical upturns and downturns in what is actually a cycle in inflation. And this is, you know, it's a paradigm shift. It's a different vantage point. This is very different than your kind of mainstream way of looking at inflation. And in fact, when you look at it this way, you see that there are many more inflation cycles than business cycles. And the chart 3 of the chart deck makes that pretty evident because it juxtaposes business cycles, and I think people are familiar with business cycle shading, with inflation cycles. And you see something else, which is kind of revealing once you see it, is that the vast majority of inflation cycles are unrelated to actual business cycle recessions. And if you let that sink in, it becomes pretty obvious why the Fed's reliance on the Phillips curve has or had been so damaging. They've kind of been walking away from that recently. So, in fact, if your framework for thinking about inflation, where inflation is headed, is relying on the output gap or full employment, and most economists have long held that that's the way to look at it, you know, our research, what I'm showing you here, reveals that you're going to get caught flat-footed and often looking the wrong way on inflation. So, a good case in point to really drive this home, because I want to make a strong point about what's going on today, but I think you need to understand a little bit of the history, is 4 years ago, just ahead of the last presidential election. And then on the flip side, in 2018. So in 2015-16, some listeners will remember there was a global slowdown, and it kind of hit the U.S. and the industrial sector in particular, and our indicators caught all that. And following that global slowdown, there was this secular stagnation thesis. If you go back to whatever the research reports, then everybody was talking about it. And basically, the low growth and lowflation had cemented kind of the narrative around inflation and the bond market and all of that. And it really helped push 10-year yields down to a record low by the summer of 16. It was pretty extreme for the time. And of course, inflation expectations were really low back then too. But now, leading indicators of the inflation cycle, just the same way we have leading indicators of growth or recessions and stuff like that, separate leading indicators. Once you know it's a separate cycle, you work on separate leading indicators. And so we have something called the future inflation gauge. And that future inflation gauge is a leading indicator of inflation, and it took off. In 16, it foresaw the upturn, which was the opposite of the narrative in the markets, right? So as a result, that cyclical reflation really blindsided the markets. Around the 2016 election, our leading indicators of growth had been pointing to the strongest growth since 2010. So we had synchronized global growth, inflation moving higher. The impact was the mood of policymakers was ecstatic. It was palpable. By mid-2017, they really were convinced, not only the Fed, ECB, other banks, they were really convinced that we had turned a corner in a structural sense. That's how far they talked themselves into this. And they believed that the era of low trend growth and low inflation, all that secular stagnation, they believed it was over. They didn't understand it was just a cycle. And this is why it sets us up for like these policy mistakes, basically. This is why the Fed kept hiking rates through the end of 2018, especially following the Trump tax cuts in 17. That all helped the bond bear market thesis take hold. And if you remember summer of 2018, you had a lot of big shots. All the bond kings and queens and all were pounding the table. They were like 4, 5, even 6% 10-year treasury yields. This is it. This is our big call. And of course, you know, we're sitting here looking at cycles. We're not following that kind of thematic or event-driven narrative. We're just looking at the cycle indicators. And the FIG turned down in early 2018. So again, based on our understanding of cycles, we're looking the other way. And by the summer, we're saying, whoa, there's an inflation cycle downturn. And the sequence of what unfolded there is really interesting, right? So the future inflation gauge actually peaked in early 18. Inflation itself, actual inflation, peaked in July of 18. Bond yields, okay, they were slow on the uptake, but they got there. They peaked out in November of 18. And the Fed was the slowest of all. And they didn't pivot until January of 19. So, I mean, you can wait for the Fed or you could wait for bond yields. But I think in terms of risk management, cycle risk management, you can do better if you can let go of some of the output gap and all that kind of stuff and look at inflation cycles. I think that's the real kind of offering here. You know, and now the Fed has said that it's just given up on the Phillips curve and they're not even going to try to be preemptive, really. They don't know how. So the bond market, it seems, is fully fixated on an event-driven view of inflation. And you know, it's like, okay, there's, you know, the Trump tax cuts cemented the confidence in the bond bear market in 18. And now, you know, around the election, markets were kind of betting on a blue wave delivering, you know, a big stimulus package, which would then push rates higher. And instead, you know, we got a purple wave of sorts and yields took a little step back very recently before the Pfizer vaccine came out. And that's another event. And it boosted the yields back up. In other words, you know, it's like the bond market is just at the mercy of the next big event. And that seems to be all that's left of the analytical framework. Because I don't think the markets, and I don't really think the Fed really understand, I know the Fed doesn't understand inflation cycles.
Locke, talk to me a little more about how we interpret this chart on page 4, where we see the U.S. FIG, the future inflation gauge. Okay, looks like it's back above 100 now. 100 was the 1992 baseline. I guess, you know, you could read this either a couple of ways. One way you could say is, okay, well, it's sloping up here clearly. This must mean more inflation is coming. We should be setting our portfolios up to hedge for more inflation coming. The other way to look at it would be to say, well, gee, if I look across the what's shown here, which I guess is really just 2020, we're kind of coming back to a high point. Maybe it's peaking. Maybe it's about to roll over. How do I interpret this? What does this mean in terms of what might be coming next?
I like your initial interpretation. Be prepared for inflation to continue to surprise to the upside. You know, as you said, on page 4, there's a picture of the future inflation gauge. And what's interesting there, first and foremost, just to underscore it, that gauge is rising in a pronounced, pervasive, and persistent way, meaning that it is pointing to the cycle in inflation continuing to rise as far as we can see, which is a couple of quarters. So actual inflation should continue to rise over that time frame. And then we keep updating the future inflation gauge to see if there's a risk developing on the horizon of a downturn a couple of quarters later. We don't see that today. You could see from the chart it's going to the upside. Now, the other thing just to underscore is that view on inflation, right, is pretty objective. It's not driven by any events. It originally wasn't driven by, you know, the election or, you know, the gaming of a stimulus package or a vaccine. None of that figures into this. What we're monitoring are cycle dynamics, which I think are actually more powerful than all of those, even those are pretty colorful stories. I think the actual cycle dynamic in inflation is stronger. And, you know, just observing again, the 10-year yield, as low as it was, has just about doubled off its March lows. So that's something. Now, you know, inflation is going to keep rising in coming months, and the Fig will warn us when it's going to peak. What kind of gets interesting, right? Because I'm sitting here staring at that. I know because I have a pretty high conviction, having used these indicators for decades, that there's a very, very, very strong risk that inflation is going to keep surprising to the upside. So I'm thinking ahead and being like, huh, all right, so the Fed has promised to do nothing. But, you know, if that Fig doesn't turn down, what's going to happen when PCE deflator, that's the target of the Fed's rough target, when that growth tops 2.5% or 3%? You know, if the Fig doesn't go down, that's going to happen at some point. And what's the Fed going to do? That's a real interesting moment, right? And I think if the Fig is continuing to rise, then, you know, they're going to be in between a rock and a hard place. They're going to start hemming and hawing all over the place. And you know, I guess it's also possible that the Fig turns down. We're watching for that. I can't predict the predictors. But this, I think, is critical to your original interpretation. You should be prepared. Do not be surprised by inflation rising more than expected over the next couple of quarters. And so to kind of take that inflation cycle risk and where is the cycle in growth going, they're both going to the upside. It is a real cyclical reflation call. You know, that impacts nominal GDP, which certainly has a relationship with nominal yields. So I'd kind of wrap it up by saying, bottom line, if you manage risk based on the cyclical direction of growth and inflation, you don't have to be a predictor of where COVID is headed or when is the vaccine actually out or, you know, who won what election or other events that are going to come on the radar screen.
I want to back up to page 3 and just talk about different time frames here, because something you said a couple of times is these indicators are designed to look ahead maybe a couple of quarters. And as we can see here on page 3, you're talking really about cyclical patterns in inflation and in growth and in your other indicators that are tracking growth. I want to talk about a different question or a different subject, which is I see this. I can clearly see how it's very useful to have these separate indicators that are telling us where inflation is headed on a cyclical basis. But hang on, separate from the cyclical discussion, I've had a prediction I've been making for years, frankly, and I've always said, I don't know, it could be many years off. But at some point, I think that a secular, not cyclical, but secular shift toward much bigger inflation, I'm talking 1970s scale inflation and stagflation, I think it's coming. And the reasons that I say that are, look, we've had this disinflationary backdrop for years and years. The Fed's been stimulating into it as much as they think they can get away with. Now, all of a sudden, we see the growing popularity of MMT among policymakers. At some point, we're going to generate a whole lot of inflation, and I think that it really is going to be a game changer in terms of limiting monetary policy choices once it takes hold. But I've also been the first to admit that, you know, I'm really convinced it's coming, but it could still be 3 or 4 years away. how do I know when inflation starts taking off? You know, do I look at this chart and say, well, look, you haven't really gone above 3 or 4% in the last decade. Once it gets to 3%, that's the top of the range. That's when it's going to reverse. You want to start to be hedging your portfolio for disinflation at that point. When do I say, wait a minute, it's the secular shift. It's upon us. It's happening now.
Well, I think, look, on a very near-term tactical basis, look, I don't disagree with you, right? You know, in our past, we've talked many, many times, Eric. And so in one of our earlier discussions, we talked about the long-term trend decline in trend growth, the lowflation, and how the only policy response there has been, you know, lowering rates or QE or all this stuff to undermine the currencies and to push out debt, and debt fuels growth and all that stuff, and trying to get bubbles and how that zombifies stuff. We've had all that discussion, right? And now this COVID recession has taken something that might have taken another 4 or 5 years for us to get to in terms of monetary policy and scrunched it into a few months, right? And where do we go from here? You know, there's this lack of policy alternatives, right? So it's a little noteworthy that there's more and more talk about central bank digital currencies and, you know, what other tools are they going to develop in coming years to try and goose the economy here and there if the fiscal side's not really functioning. And so, you know, I don't know exactly where they're going to go with that and how long it'll take to get there. But it seems like the policy response is very much centered on the central banks and messing around with debt and liquidity and possibly currencies, right? So currency volatility is probably in our future in the broadest sense. As to which exact scenario is going to win out, I can't make a strong conviction bet, but the future inflation gauge, the cycle information, is a useful tool. Like if you hold a longer term view, either let's say for the other half of the people who are out there on the other side of the trade saying, you know, deflation, right? Because there's a strong argument that some people are making for deflation or disinflation as a result of all this. And then you and I sympathize with that talking to the upside. The question is when. And you know, the future inflation gauge can tell us when. So I earlier in my comments was saying, hey, what is the Fed going to do when the PCE deflator gets to 2.5 or 3%? If the FIG is still rising, that's an interesting moment. But that could signal, hey, maybe we're breaking out of that 3% top in the inflation range. Maybe something is afoot at that moment. When listeners are looking at chart 3, you know, they'll see the inflation cycle upturn that in 16 through 18 kind of tricked the bond market and the Fed into believing that that was the time that you had the secular shift. That the higher, the secular, longer term persistent inflation was upon us. And in fact, it turned out it wasn't. And the FIG warned us of that at that moment. So I can't exactly bet on which is the kind of secular timing when something's going to switch, but I could say that the FIG will help us pay attention around the right time. But you should probably have a plan.
So it sounds like the plan is you watch the actual CPI print, and when it gets back to 3%, which has kind of been the ceiling for a decade, you know, really since the 08 crisis, when it gets to 3%, you look at the FIG, and if the FIG's starting to turn down, it's like, hey, baby, just another cycle. It's all ups and downs of the waves on the ocean. When the FIG's pointing straight up and you're already at 3% in U.S. CPI on the official print, Houston, we have a problem. It's time to rethink everything.
Yeah, and my guess is, you know, the Fed heads will start talking around when you get to the mid twos, right? When you get to 2.5 or so, if the FIG's still rising, they're going to start talking about this or that, And they're a little bit in a pickle because they've highlighted employment as a key marker, which is, you know, in the end of the day, it's a variation on the Phillips curve. But they're talking about more equality and employment and all of this. And because many of the lower income jobs tend to be in that front facing services sector, which is having a slow recovery, and many businesses are actually failing there, that jobs recovery may be pretty slow. So the Fed has said, here's what I'm going to watch. And, you know, inflation may not cooperate with them. And it'll be revealing to see what is their reaction function. And it seems to me, you know, and I don't know anybody really at the Fed, any, you know, a couple people, but it's not like back when Dr. Moore was around. He was Greenspan's teacher. It seems to me that everybody's event driven. That's the state of inflation analysis. And if you find that frustrating, then you go to the bigger picture and you say, whoa, that's a lot of debt. And that's a lot of stimulus. And this has to matter at some point. And I don't disagree. But the question is when. I remember I picked up once that, you know, you go to these library summer fairs and they have the books for 50 cents or a dollar. And there was some book, I think it was The Coming Currency Collapse, but it was from the 70s, right? And it was a well-argued book, I mean, I must say. But what I really enjoyed was in the back of it was a summary of the Chinese dynasties where, you know, they had been at the forefront, at the vanguard of paper money. And they had a lot of fun with it, you know, and these dynasties would eventually collapse when the currency collapsed, when the debt, the paper debt collapsed. But it could take generations in some cases. And that was kind of striking.
Locke, final question. Clearly, we're having some kind of, at least as we're speaking on Wednesday, there's some kind of pop in the markets in the last couple of days to the upside, apparently in reaction to some combination of the vaccine news and what most people consider to be an outcome of the election, although frankly, it's not official yet. It seems like it's pretty clear that most people think Biden has won the election. What's driving it, and what does Cycles work tell us about, you know, does this thing have legs? Is it time to jump in here before it gets away, or is it maybe a head fake?
Well, you know, certainly the day-to-day stuff, I think you could point to the headlines, you know, that the election, you know, has kind of unfolded. The world didn't stop running. You know, we're still here. Hey, there's also a vaccine. These are positives given some of the fears that were out there. But I would posit that if you had the view that, hey, there's a business cycle upturn, a growth rate cycle upturn that is not decelerating, it's still moving to the upside, and there's an inflation cycle upturn that, you know, barring some massive catastrophe, you'd have to be embracing risk. And that story hasn't changed as a result of the last couple of weeks. As dramatic as things have been, that fundamental cycle risk analysis is the same today as it was a couple of weeks ago. And when I look forward, I would say it's not unlike late 16 into 17, because we have, for the most part, there's a couple of spots here and there, but I'd say generally speaking, around in the US and around the world, growth is to the upside. Inflation is stronger, in a stronger upturn in the US than it is in some other countries. But around the world, it is bottoming. Those same types of inflation cycles are bottoming. So this is a variation or a rhyming version of the reflation cycle upturn that we had back in 16, 17. And of course, that was a pretty strong one. I don't see anything that would, in our current snapshot today, looking at the indicators, suggest there's risk of a downturn anywhere. I think the thing to look for is certainly if the leading indicators were to turn down, that future inflation gauge on page 4 or the weekly leading index on page 1 of the handout. And then what happens with the Fed if inflation starts bumping near into their discomfort zone? How do they How do they deal with that?
Finally, before I let you go, for people who do want to follow these indicators, about half of our audience is institutional. What are the products on offer for them, for people that want to follow your research? And we also have about half of our audience are sophisticated, high net worth individuals and other private investors. Is there a high-end retail product or is it strictly institutional?
I'm afraid it's strictly institutional. And it's not that I wouldn't want to talk to high-end net worth individuals, but I just don't have enough time. It's like, you know, there's a lot of nuance in some of these indicators. We have about 100 indicators for the world, about, you know, probably like 20 of them for the US, for all these different nooks and crannies of the cycle. And so we put out reports and data, and that's kind of an institutional arrangement. We do make a valiant effort to share what we can publicly. And I do that at businesscycle.com is the website. I think Business Cycle is the Twitter feed, and there's ECRI or Business Cycle or Lakshman Achithan on LinkedIn. And we, when we're writing stories or doing things, or even like this interview with you, Eric, at some point that'll go up into that feed too. So we try to keep that feed very active for people who aren't institutional investors but want to manage their cycle risk.
Okay, so businesscycle.com is the place to go for non-institutional, basically free stuff for the non-institutional audience. For the institutional audience, how do they contact you to find out more about your services?
They can contact Melinda at businesscycle.com, and she will give you all the information.
Locke, we look forward to getting you back on the show in 6 months or so for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Uranium, the fuel for nuclear power, is a contrarian investment whose returns are historically uncorrelated to other asset classes. Low uranium prices lasted for many years after the Fukushima meltdown, leading to substantial supply destruction. At today's prices, uranium mining is uneconomical, even for the world's lowest cost producers. Uranium demand is already estimated to exceed existing supply, and future demand growth is expected. New mines aren't economically viable at today's prices, leading analysts to predict that the price of uranium may need to double to over $60 per pound to incentivize sufficient new mine supply to meet expected demand. The NYSE-listed North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, offers investors exposure to both miners and holders of uranium. For more information, visit urnmetf.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Locke back on the show. One of the things that he keeps emphasizing, which I think is so incredibly important, is that the inflation cycle is not directly correlated to the business cycle, or they can diverge at least. And that's one thing that I didn't think at the beginning of my career, and only later did I actually start to realize that. And it's so important when he says it to emphasize that the two can really act on their own. What did you take away from the interview?
That's a really great point, Patrick, that keeping those cycles separate in your head is important. You know, this is just maybe the interview that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. There's so many smart people we've had on, and to summarize many of our feature interview guests in the last few months, the consensus is pretty darn clear, which is we're going to see a return to secular inflation. And whether that happens in 3 months or 3 years, nobody's smart enough to know. I mean, you know, let's look at how long it's been since we really had secular inflation in the 1970s. And it was, what, early 81, 82 or so that we finally broke out of that with Paul Volcker's monetary sledgehammer approach to the market. We're headed back back to some kind of secular inflation trend. I'm sure of it. And the MMT, I think, will help us get there. Do we get there in 3 months or 3 years? I don't know. If it's a 35-year cycle, you know, being wrong by 3 years is still only 10% on a timescale measure. So I don't know when it happens, but I think it's time to start planning that if this bond bull market isn't already over, that it's going to be really soon. And the next big trend is going to be inflation and a resumption of an uptrend in yields to replace the downtrend in yields that we've seen for, what, 35 years now. But Patrick, what I can predict in the short term is our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. If you don't have a research roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. S&P futures, page 2. Boy, Patrick, look at that candle with the red circle around it where we had the vaccine news.
That's for sure. Like, I actually want to look beyond this in a moment. I just wanted to give us a reference point, but it was one big breakout attempt on the S&P 500 that was almost immediately sold into. And we haven't really begun any meaningful market correction, at least not yet, because, I mean, a correction that would have us already back down toward 3,400, and we're just not seeing that yet. So, you know, I don't want to already imply anything bearish, but certainly one of the things that I would have been looking for from a news event like this is whether or not it would trigger a feedback loop of buying, and that would cause the market to just keep being up every single day, very similar to what we saw in the summer in August. And we're just not seeing that yet. And so it will be really interesting to see how it plays out. But really what I want to talk about is on page 3, which is where we have the Russell versus the NASDAQ. And this is one of the most fascinating things that happened on the vaccine news, which is essentially this idea that the economy could recover and certainly could spur inflation risks and all sorts of different variables. And what's interesting is that when we're looking on the left-hand side, we can see that the NASDAQ on that news almost immediately started to sell while the Russell went screaming higher. And literally, they went in opposite directions. And I thought that was quite significant that that was playing out that way. And we still have, since that news event, that the NASDAQ is more or less underwater from, at least it's not up since the news event. And the Russell, though, has been holding up. And that asks that question on the right-hand side, have we seen that trend shift that's been in place for years? For years, we've had a material outperformance of the NASDAQ and the FANG stocks over that of the small cap Russell. And it's not just been a 2020 event in this coronavirus period. We've seen that trend in place for many, many years. And there was inevitably was going to come a point where that trend was going to shift and small caps and international stocks may start to outperform. Now, one day or one week doesn't make a new trend, but technically we've had a substantial basing throughout much of this year on the Russell over the NASDAQ chart. And it's just an interesting question to ask as to whether or not this is the beginning of a breakout here.
Well, Patrick, it seems like that underperformance is on the NASDAQ, which I assume is mostly being driven by the FANG Plus stocks. Let's look at page 4, where you've got the FANG Plus index. You know, this seems to me like sideways consolidation. Didn't get the new all-time high test like we saw on the S&P. What do you interpret out of this chart?
Well, let's see. I would even go and look underneath the surface while I don't have the charts up here. What is interesting is substantial breakdowns in the last week or two on everything from Facebook to Amazon to Netflix. Microsoft has been somewhat weak. Twitter has broken down a lot. The only one of the FANG stocks that actually continues to have a very clean trend and positive price action has to be Google. And that's like the last one of the FANG stocks standing from in terms of that. And so really, this is something I'm watching because really we've seen this period where this index was the leadership. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether that baton is passed and whether other parts of the market start to outperform. And even if this sector doesn't have to necessarily crash, but will it underperform and will that not be where the money is flowing is one of the more interesting things to kind of find out in the coming weeks as we see how this develops into the new year. So what I wanted to, though, move on here is to page 5, where we have the Euro stock. And what's fascinating here is that even before the vaccine news came out, but the vaccine news gave it an extra boost, we have just seen a huge rip higher in the Euro stock, up 20% in just 2 weeks. It's just been screaming higher, but more importantly, it has now exceeded all of the summer highs. One of the characteristics that we've seen in the Euro stock was that it was just dragging. And while the US equity markets kept plugging higher and higher, the Euro stock was just dead money and just couldn't get off of the mat. And with this big rally higher, the question is, are we seeing a shift where global developed markets can actually outperform the US equity markets? Maybe that's a correlated to the Russell as well. And what we can see if we go to page 6 was where the Japanese Nikkei as well in the last 2 weeks has just had an extraordinary breakout, finally breaking out of those January, February highs. And it just doing so with a great momentum. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not these international markets can actually continue to outperform in the coming weeks. So Eric, let's move on to crude oil here. And so we're looking at the December contract. And one of the interesting things is how strong this recovery has been in the last 2 weeks off that low. At the late October, early November, we were establishing a low down in the Fibonacci zones around the 34 handle. And since then, we go screaming higher, consolidating well above those highs of September and October. And it's just what a quick flip. And it really asked the question, was this a meaningful shift in the oil markets, and how does this play out from here? What's your take on this?
Well, Patrick, it's really, really interesting because if I look at what I see on this chart, it really does look like the long-awaited breakout is perhaps finally starting. I've been saying all summer long that I thought basically, okay, we had that really big move up off of the April lows, then we've been consolidating, and I really think at some point we're going to see another significant move up to sustain prices above $50 a barrel, and eventually, not immediately, but I'd say by the end of 2021, I wouldn't be surprised if we're in the $75 plus range, and the reason is we will have destroyed so much supply capacity. And when demand comes back, and it's certainly not right now, but eventually, you know, there really is going to be a resolution to the pandemic and the economy will be reopened and travel will be happening again. When all those things happen, we're not going to be able to produce the oil that we need to keep up with it. And prices are going through the roof. And I thought, okay, maybe finally the market is starting to sniff this out. But if I look at the news flow, what really is happening, regardless of the Pfizer vaccine news, which frankly is mostly hype and hoopla as far as I'm concerned, the real news here is we've got a parabolic rise in both new cases, new infections, and in deaths. And at the same time, we've also got this mink strain news, which could have very negative consequences in terms of prolonging the COVID-19 crisis longer than anybody expected. So I would have expected this news flow to give us one last a test of the bottom of the lows, and we're seeing a test of the high end of the range instead. It really doesn't make sense to me. Maybe it's just time that this rally is ready to move on in anticipation of that decline in U.S. production capability that Art Berman is still projecting at the end of this quarter and into next year. It's hard to say. I really am surprised that we're seeing this much strength on this particular news flow right now.
You know, one of the things I'm going to be watching is actually how well the bulls defend it, right? Because if we find that by Monday or Tuesday, crude oil's back below 38, then it could make it that just like how we saw in the stock market, it could have just been everyone getting a little too excited too quickly. And then some smart money comes in there and starts to distribute into it. But if we see that the price action holds up in the 40s and really consolidates up here, that would demonstrate that it's not only got up to this price levels, but it's actually being well defended up here. And that would be something that would be very impressive by next week when we're doing the show, if we saw prices hold up there. But what I wanted to touch on page 8 was touching on the energy equities. And so here I have the Spider Energy ETF, which is the symbol XLE. And those energy stocks had a 20% update, just went screaming higher. And what's interesting about this is that the energy stocks in many ways were throughout the summer predicting that oil was going to stay weak, in a sense that they were very well distributed. There was no follow through to any rallies, and they just kept selling and selling, even though oil was holding up. And what's interesting here is that we, for the first time, we've seen this space come to life. And I'm going to be very curious to see whether this is an indication that equity investors in this space are actually seeing a light at the end of the tunnel and starting to accumulate this space. A few days don't make a new trend. I don't want to get overexcited too quickly, but it is certainly something that's important to watch. So Eric, moving on, I want to just touch on uranium briefly. What is interesting is that after several months of consolidation, here I have the chart of the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, the URNM. And what's interesting is that we're seeing some breakout attempts on the upside after some consolidation. What will be really interesting to see is whether or not this buying follows through north of 30. And that's something I think we're going to keep a close eye on going into next week.
Yeah, I bought both URNM and YCA after the uranium show that we did a few weeks ago. URNM is doing much better than YCA is to the upside, so it seems to be working pretty well. But I saw also, and I don't have much detail on this, we'll try to get more for you next week, but I think one of the things that we lamented on that show is how ridiculous is it that the United States doesn't have some kind of strategic reserve for uranium to keep uranium on hand so that we could supply our nuclear power industry if the global supply chains were ever cut off due to political crisis. It sounds like there's now a budget from the Senate that's been proposed. I don't know whether this is a done deal or just somebody's proposal, but maybe they're listening to Macro Voices. I don't know. It sounds like maybe they're going to create a strategic uranium reserve similar to the strategic petroleum reserve. Certainly, I think it's overdue. We'll try to get more information on that before next week's show.
All right. Well, let's move on to page 10. And I just wanted to illustrate that support line on gold that we have approached. I mean, in that one fluid motion on that reaction earlier this week, we came right back to those September, October lows. And this is such a critical moment because in my mind, if gold can't recover back to, let's say, 1920 in the coming week, and the price action stays down here, it's like a little bit of an edge of a cliff. And if we see that price action breaking below there, then this consolidation may head down south of 1800. Now, I'm not in any way big picture bearish, and that probably would lead to a buying opportunity if it did. But watching how it reacts along the support line is definitely one of the key things to watch this week.
Well, and the fascinating thing to me, Patrick, these are daily bars, but if you were to zoom in and look at that huge red bar on Monday, most of that happened in very, very short order on the Pfizer vaccine news. And you would think that as the stock market retraced most of its knee-jerk reaction, that the gold market would have retraced too, but gold went down and stayed down. And I'm hopeful that we will get a deeper correction. I'd love to have a chance to buy some more. Couple of technical levels that I'm watching are the 200-day moving average, which is at 1798 and a half right now, moving higher every day. There's also another technical level at about 1757, which was the daily R2 resistance level. We'll see what happens here, but it's very, very curious to me that the tape action is what it is here, and the reaction to the same news event is completely different in the stock market.
Right. And so the last chart I wanted to touch on is just looking at the U.S. high yield credit spreads. And one of the most interesting things that's going on is that we continue to see yields rising on U.S. government bonds. So treasury bonds are very, very weak. And we've also, on investment grade corporate bonds, seen highs all the way back in July and August. And generally, they've been treading water since. But when we go to junk bonds and all our high yield bonds, they're making multi-month highs and pushed higher, obviously with some correlation to the equity markets and this idea that there could be a recovery. But this has pushed the spread down toward 400 basis points. And so this junk bond market is not at all pricing in the fact that there's got to be some wave of defaults coming from this coronavirus. And even if the Fed is buying it, at what point do you price in that the Fed can't stop companies from having some rise in defaults? And I ask the question, is this being priced in or is this mispriced? And I tend to be in the camp thinking that this is mispriced, and considering that we're already seeing weakness broadly in the bond markets, it'll be really interesting to see where this starts to turn.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole new world that we live in, Patrick. It used to be that you looked at default risk objectively and that affected price. And now price maybe is affected by default risk, but probably to a greater extent. The expectation is the Fed has already bought junk bonds and will probably buy more and will probably not be that concerned about those default rates. And it might even be buying them in reaction to those defaults that you're talking about coming in order to defend or save the market from capitalism actually happening the way it's supposed to. So I don't know what's coming next, but in this world that we live in, I think anything is possible. Folks, don't forget that Patrick does webinars 4 days a week with all of these great chart decks. You can get a free trial of his service, Big Picture Trading. Information for signing up is on page 12. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode was made possible by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium, and by Masterworks.io, which gives investors of any size the opportunity to invest in the $1.7 trillion fine art market through fractional ownership. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Locke's slides and the chart book we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to a Jesse Felder article that this is the textbook definition of late cycle in the stock market, and a link to an article discussing that good news could actually lose you money. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.